Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
All right, welcome back to the Disruption Zone. Fun episode today. Those of you who know me and have known me for a long time know that you can't quite put me in the Republican corral. Most of my views are conservative. I tend to lean libertarian. I've always said that my political party is don't tread on me and I won't tread on you, with a tinge of Reaganism splashed in here and there. But that being said, one of the websites that I use for show prep most often is a site called hotair.com. And the reason I like them is because they print stuff from across the conservative spectrum and even sometimes things from the liberal point of view. And it gives you a better analysis of the things that are going on in the world. And it kind of sometimes will challenge your preconceived viewpoint. It'll surprise you a little bit. And that's the kind of dialogue that I like to see out there. And one of my favorite writers on hotair.com is Taylor Millard. Taylor, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
I'm doing just fine, Leland. It's good to talk with you.
You as well. There's a range of things I wanted to chat with you today on the podcast, but I got to start with this that has absolutely nothing to do with politics or anything. Have you seen The Irishman on Netflix yet?
I have not. Okay. That's been on the list.
All right. I don't want to do a buzzkill here, and I don't want to be like that guy that kind of destroys the plot or anything, so I won't do that. But I'm just going to tell you, I was super disappointed with it. My wife and I watched it last night. It's 3.5 hours long. It's about 2.5 hours too long. Does that make sense? It's like they could have done that in an hour, and it would have been superb. But I was really disappointed in it, man. I was like, I was expecting with all the cast that was in it. I mean, it's truly an all-star cast. But I was expecting, I don't know, I'm probably wrong on this, but have Robert De Niro and Al Pacino been in a movie together since Heat? I'm trying to think if they have.
I don't think they have. I want to say there was something. Actually, no, they have. I can't remember the film. But okay, it was one of those in the early 2000s, mid 2000s.
So it was not memorable. Well, neither was this one. I love watching the two of them together because they're such like behemoth actors. I was just disappointed in Martin Scorsese. It seemed like a watered down Martin Scorsese film. It seemed like a, to put it bluntly, a run of the mill mobster film. It gets kudos for being the story about Jimmy Hoffa. I mean, it's based on the, you know, sort of an adaptation of Frank the Irishman Sheeran's confessional account of, at the end of his life. But, God, it just unfolded. Joe Pesci was the highlight of the movie. A lot of people see him as being kind of stuck in that sort of Home Alone, you know, plot where he's supposed to be a comedic actor. He's actually a really good actor all around. I mean, he has to play the mob spot. But still, he was fantastic in this movie. Probably the highlight of it.
Well, Pesci is just he really is a great actor, and also had one of the all time best Oscar speeches where he, you know, when he won for Goodfellas.
Yeah.
And he got up there and he was like, "Thank y'all," and then walked off. You know, he didn't go on forever.
Yeah.
But the point being is he really is an amazing actor in that he could do the spectrum, you know. I'm familiar with him because of Home Alone. He's really funny.
Right.
You know, at the same time, he can be a really serious actor.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the, you know, good actors are the ones who can do that, which is what I really like about Pesci.
You should go ahead and watch this movie. I don't want to discourage you from watching it because there are highlights in it that, like Joe Pesci, his acting and, you know, elements of the story that are just gripping, but at the same time, it's fell well below what I was expecting from Martin Scorsese and the level of actors that are in the movie. Just my personal opinion.
There's someone out there who has actually like put it down to three hour-long episode, so you can watch it like a mini-series.
Perfect.
And I heard it comes off a lot better that way.
Yeah, that would be absolutely perfect. Then you would be kind of hooked. You'd be like, all right, well, we'll do it again tomorrow night. So that's kind of perfect. It's kind of like Texas Rising, that History Channel bit that's like – it's two-hour episodes broken down into what? I think it's like four two-hour episodes, something like that, kind of telling the story of the Alamo and all that. So, interesting. All right. Well, Taylor, wanted to talk to you about a couple of things that are kind of in the news right now. Let's begin with Hong Kong. It's kind of died down now, and people aren't paying as much attention to it as they were at the beginning. But what's happening there, I think, is super important for democracy around the world. And it's one of those instances. Let me go back and give a little bit of kind of historical perspective here. When President Obama was president and the quote unquote Arab Spring was supposedly happening, the president missed the boat on all of that. Most of that was just fomented theocratic leaders that were taking advantage of gaps in power, and it was being framed as a democratic uprising. The real democratic uprising was happening in Iran, and we completely ignored it. And it was Western educated and students and young people that wanted a Western style democracy that were rising up against the Ayatollah, and they were put down brutally. And President Obama said absolutely nothing and instead favored the Muslim Brotherhood in other countries like Tunisia and Egypt, etc. And it became a complete mess. We have another sort of similar situation brewing in Hong Kong where, you know, it's not that we need to get involved militarily, but when America speaks in support of democracy, it means something on the world stage. And what is happening in Hong Kong is this little bitty place where these people are sick and tired of the autocratic sort of statist philosophy of China, and they're pushing back. And you've been studying this a lot more than I have. So give me your assessment of what's actually happening there on the ground.
Well, and it's interesting. I've been reading a book called Umbrella, A Political Tale from Hong Kong, which by Kong Sung Gan, and Kong, if I'm mispronouncing it, sorry. Just look for Umbrella, A Political Tale from Hong Kong on your favorite online web store. And what it does is it categorizes or it kind of looks at the 2014 umbrella protests for universal suffrage, which happened in Hong Kong back in 2014, so 6 years ago. And the thing that's really interesting, which the book points out, is this has been boiling for over a century. This is not just a China thing, you know. People forget the fact that the United Kingdom, Great Britain, leased Hong Kong from China for 99 years, starting in 1898. And the reason why it was 99 years was the British diplomat who was involved in the agreement was like, oh, 99 years is forever, so let's just do that. So there was no representation really for Hong Kong or for Hong Kongers during that time period when they were under the Brits. Yeah, they had economic success, but they were still beholden to UK's, you know, kind of whims and stuff like that. So when China said to Great Britain in the mid-80s, hey, we're taking Hong Kong back when this lease is over in 98, and there's nothing you can do to get us to do something else, and Britain wasn't going to go to war with China in 89. Their power had substantially reduced. You know, they were no longer the global leader like they were in the late 1800s. You know, they kind of had to go with this agreement. So what China said was, for 50 years, when we take over, for 50 years, we are going to actually implement a system of, or a more of a system of democracy. You guys will get to, you guys will get universal suffrage, meaning, you know, voting for leaders. And they never did that. And they've kind of done quasi systems of it, but it wasn't really doing what they promised it was going to do. The most elections they have are for district council races, which are really more of advisors to the government, not actual policy setters. So when China enacted this extradition bill last year, and what the extradition bill was going to be was, you know, basically allowing people who were arrested in Hong Kong to then be taken to China for prosecution, you had these protests kick off because they're like, they're cracking down on pro-democracy people. And so that's why all these protests started last year and are still going on today, even with the outbreak of coronavirus. They're still going on.
What is preventing China from just breaking its back? Just saying that's it. I mean, they do that in their own, in mainland China. They do it all the time. If there's a dissident, they end up in jail. If there's a protest, they just quell it. Is it because Hong Kong is that hotspot where there's this sort of at least guise of some level of freedom, and it's also an economic powerhouse? And so they just sort of, it's like the wayward stepchild of communism? Or what is it that holds China back from just slaughtering these people in the streets? Thank God they don't do it, but still.
It's a bit of a mix, to be honest. You know, when, because of the Hong Kong economy, because of how big of an economic driver it is, you know, if the Chinese government decided to send the army in, and, you know, they've had the army kind of chill out there. You know, they had a very, last fall, they had a very public replacement of the garrison, the Chinese government or the Chinese army garrison, military garrison, which is right outside of Hong Kong. It was one of the more public displays that they'd ever had in, going back to where they took over. You know, the issue that you run into is you would be destroying that economy.
Right.
And you would be destroying, you know, the region itself if you just push the army in there. The Hong Kong police have been getting a ton of criticism for how they've been acting in this. The government has been meaning the Hong Kong government has been accused of allowing police brutality to go on and to not really do an investigation into the use of force police have done. I mean, they've sent in, you know, people to look at or undercover police officers they've sent in to the protests in trying to, you know, be like, oh, we're protesters, but in reality they're undercover police officers.
You mean like our government does from time to time?
Yeah, pretty much. you know, they've been doing all that.
Yeah.
And so that's what you're running into. And that's one of the reasons why things have gotten so violent. There's been kind of a cause and effect of people pushing back against their government.
What part of this story is the mainstream media not covering?
You know, when it comes to the cycle of news, the news cycle is always, you always have to look for something that's bigger and that's more interesting. And I would just say, you know, the fact that most of these protests really are peaceful. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there has been violence. Let's be honest. There has been violence. You've seen protesters throw bombs and Molotov cocktails at police. But it's not one of those situations where it's complete and utter chaos, although it's really come close from time to time. I think the fact that this is still going on is one of the things which people have kind of forgotten, because Hong Kong isn't burning as much as it had been at the end of last year. You know, it's become more organized to protest wise. You know, people have gotten more involved in the quasi elections there are there. And, you know, people are looking for the latest cool thing, quote unquote, in news to cover, whether it's impeachment, whether it's coronavirus, whether it's tensions with Iran, whether it's, you know, insert, you know, Kobe Bryant's horrific death and the eight other people, you know, his daughter and the seven other people who were killed. It's not saying that stuff isn't important.
Right.
Okay. That's not saying that, but you know, the Hong Kong thing has been, you know, has just been bubbling for years, and it doesn't look like it's going to stop, which is actually a good thing.
Well, by the way, the coronavirus is a complete distraction by the media. It's nothing more than the common cold. And I find it hilarious that literally more people have died from the flu already this year than from the entire breakout of the coronavirus, like thousands more. It's literally just the common cold. I think it was put out there because the case that the Nancy Pelosi's ploy in the House was falling apart, and I think the mainstream media was just distracting from that whole process by going, oh my God, everybody get one of these masks and save your life. The thing that I guess when I hear about Hong Kong, though, how are they able to organize protests given the level of surveillance and invasiveness that the Chinese government has? Are they not using those tools in Hong Kong as they would in mainland China? How are these people even able to organize given the power that China has over people's thought processes?
There is this thing called this motto of theirs, of the protesters, called "Be Like Water," which basically means you slip in, you know, you kind of quietly get in there. Mm-hmm. You kind of quietly get involved in doing protests. You know, they're not, it's not quite a flash mob, but it's almost close to one. And, you know, the other thing is you have people who are so determined to get their message out, they're not letting the government affect them as much as the government would like to.
Right.
And, you know, when it comes to facial recognition, when it comes to, you know, the stuff involving surveillance, this is one of the reasons why you're seeing people in Hong Kong wearing masks, is because they're trying to break away from the surveillance to make it harder
right.
for China to do the facial recognition. And, you know, it's fascinating to watch this because of how, like, you have pro-China people there who aren't just, you know, China, they aren't Chinese government members, although some of them are. You know, you have the triads who may be who appear to be involved with the Chinese government because they want the status quo to stick around because it benefits them.
They're the mob, so they're right? Wearing, I mean, so people understand this. That's the mob, right? The Chinese
mafia. Yeah, pretty much. That's their version of the mob.
Only they work directly with government, whereas here in America, there was only tacit connections to the government, I guess.
You know, it's a mix. I you know, it's corruption, right?
Right.
So when you have corruption, you're going to have bad people, you know, hook up with other bad people.
Right.
You know, when you have, you know, so you have that going on. You have, and they're the blues, I think they're called, is what Wall Street Journal reported, is that they're the blues. You have the Greens, which are the people who are basically just like, nope, we're neutral in this. We're staying out of this. We don't want to get involved in this. And then you have the protesters who, you know, they've worn black, they've worn, you know, multiple other, you know, it's mostly black they've been wearing. And so the lines are really drawn there. And, you know, the big thing this year is going to be the September elections for legislative council.
Right.
Because that would actually give democracy advocates more of a say if they are able to get more of a you know, position in the legislative council.
So what should we do in America?
So that's kind of the big question, isn't it? Because you can sit there and you can say, all right, the government should do something about it. And I think that's what a lot of Americans kind of sit there, and a lot of people in general kind of sit there and say, well, the government should do something. You know, if we're going to do something, it should be the government. There are things individuals can do. And, you know, one of the, which is outside of, you know, the hashtag division of social media, which, don't get me wrong, it's good to tweet hashtags, but there's more people can do. You know, I actually donated money to Demosisto, which is one of the major Hong Kong democracy groups out there. And the way I donated money, I actually bought a shirt from them, and they sent it to me. It was pretty amazing. You know, Hong Kong was sending, you know, then a Hong Kong group was able to send it to some dude in Texas.
I love it.
You know, you can.
Is there a website I can go to if I want to support this and I want to like walk around proudly with a T-shirt?
So Demosisto's website is it's Demosisto, Demosisto.hk.
Got it. I got it up here. I'm just pulling it up.
And you know, and here's the thing, you know, they say they promote democracy and progressive values.
I understand nothing other than the only thing I understand on this is the picture of the fist, the picture of people walking, the picture of coins, and the Facebook and Twitter, the Facebook and Twitter logos. That's all.
There is an English translation that they did, which is actually because English, you know, the funny thing is that English is also like one of the major languages there.
Yeah.
It's not just.
Oh, there it is. I found it. There's ENG on the end, and you just click that.
Yeah.
And then it's in English. Okay. No, that's cool. I think I'm going to buy a shirt. I really do. So, in order, it just kind of with this particular topic, where do you see this going? Is it going to be successful or not?
You know something? It's not going to go away. You know, this is the thing that I think, you look at everything which has been going on in Hong Kong ever since Great Britain took over in 1898. You know, the promise of, okay, you guys will get to do your own thing. You guys will have universal suffrage. You guys will, which means voting for all. You look at all of that, and it's not going to go away. The only question there is really what is China going to do to tamp down on these protests? Are they going to actually give in to, to the demands of the five demands, not one less, of the protesters, which is the withdrawal of the extradition bill, an independent probe into use of force by police, amnesty for arrested protesters, you stop calling the protests riots, and the implementation of universal suffrage. Is China going to give into those demands, which they should? Are they going to do that, or are they going to just say, you know something, screw this, we're going to burn Hong Kong to the ground? The cynic in me says they're going to burn things to the ground. Hong Kong is going to end up being burned to the ground.
Yeah. That would be a huge hit to the world economy, by the way.
That would be a major mistake.
Yeah.
But, you know, authoritarians want to authoritate.
Yeah. By the way, I'm going to buy one of these shirts, the black one. It's badass. But I can guarantee you that since I'm on this website, I'm probably already a target of the Chinese government. So what the heck? I'm already a target of the NSA, so I might as well be a target of the Chinese government. Hopefully that, you know, we can see more support rise amongst people. And I think the key to supporting this is to understanding the movement. This is not This is not Occupy Wall Street. That's not the movement that's happening here. These people want liberty.
It's not even the Tea Party. It's more than that.
Right. These people want liberty. They want freedom. They want freedom of thought. They want freedom of expression. They want freedom to bear arms. They want freedom of economies. It's not. This is not your typical young people uprising. This is a group of people that are young, but they're mature beyond their years, and they're demanding Western-style democracy. That's what they're demanding. And, you know, it's inspirational in, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it definitely is. It is one of the most important it's one of the most important things going on in the world right now. It's one of the biggest stories of the century.
Yeah, I mean, it's nuanced. It's like, okay, you know, the French Revolution came after the American Revolution and somewhat modeled itself after us, but they were not as nuanced as we were in that sense. I mean, historically, what we were looking for was far more broad, and that's why, as great as the French Revolution might have started out, at the end, you get Les Mis, right? I mean, because it became more of that sort of, you know, it became more of an us versus them and more of a, you know, poor versus rich and more of a, you know, that kind of thing, as opposed to we just want freedom. We want the ability to own land. We want the ability to not be taxed without representation. We want to be able to defend ourselves. What you're seeing happening in Hong Kong, I think, is more nuanced, much more like the American Revolution, in my opinion. Maybe I'm off on that, but that's how I see it, at least from what I know of it.
They want more of a say in what goes on in their government,
right,
which is a good thing. You know, I think that if you were to sit down and to have discussions about, you know, what policies they would want, you could sit there and say, okay, you know, maybe you don't want to do that. Maybe you want to do more this, maybe, you know.
Right.
But these are people who want their freedom.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, are fighting an authoritarian regime. And there are things individuals can do to support them.
Right.
Which is the biggest thing.
Yeah.
People need to remember,
yep,
is individuals can help, and there are ways to do it.
All right. We both lean libertarian. I think you are actually a libertarian. Is that right?
I am a small L libertarian. I'm not a member of the party. I'm not a member of any party.
Yeah, myself as well. Yeah.
Which is really nice. But, you know, I have voted for Republicans. I voted for Libertarians. I voted for Democrats from time to time, depending on, you know.
Okay, so here's the question. Here's the question: Who is more libertarian leaning, Donald Trump or Tulsi Gabbard?
You know,
it's a tough question, isn't it?
It's a tough question. I, you know, the thing that people, that draws libertarians to Gabbard is her stance on foreign policy. And her
that and free speech.
On, yeah, and her stance on surveillance.
Yeah.
Now, she has very non-libertarian positions.
Right.
You know, I would not, I'll just put it this way, right? Her stance on foreign policy and free, you know, and surveillance and stuff is not enough to make me vote for her.
Right.
Like, you look at her from an economic standpoint and from a, you know, from a social policy standpoint. When I say social policy, I'm talking about, you know, healthcare. I'm right. talking about, you know, I'm talking about that sort of thing. She's in line with Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So she is not. You know, she's not this libertarian hero. She's not free markets. You know, she talks about, you know, breaking up big tech, which, you know, I'm not a fan of breaking up big tech. I understand the arguments for it. You know, my belief on that is, instead of breaking up big tech, how about you stop giving them, you know, tax breaks,
right?
You know, individual tax breaks.
Stop subsidizing them, and they won't get so big.
Yeah, stop subsidizing them, and they won't become so big.
Yeah.
You know, that is, you know, that's the major issue from a foreign policy standpoint. You know, who is more libertarian than, you know, between Gabbard and Trump? Gabbard is
right. But at the same time, Trump attracts a lot of small L libertarians because he still believes in a strong defense, which is me. He's willing to use that strong defense, but his overall overarching goal is to get us out of these entanglements and make our allies pay more of, you know, their share in defending the free world, so to speak. So, like, but I agree with you. I think on some cases, like, I look at Trump and I say, in terms of personal economy, he's the most libertarian president in my lifetime. In terms of personal economies, in terms of the broader economy, when he gets involved in trade wars and some of the other types of things that he engages in, he's very much not libertarian. So, you know, I see those two lines of his thought converging at some point and running into a wall, so to speak. Like, you know, right now the economy's rocking and rolling. It's really hot. If he wins this trade war with China, things could be great for a few more years. But the danger of, you know, using tariffs and taxing your own people in order to punish other countries, you could potentially run into a brick wall there where all the good stuff you're doing for the individual economy isn't good enough to overcome what you're doing with the macro economy. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I can't, you know, I cannot separate the two.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, let's remember, you know, you talked about the individual, you know, oh, he's great on individual economy. Well, is he? I mean, he's talking about, you know, doing a ban on vaping or on flavored vapes.
Right.
You know, that's, I know plenty of people who have quit smoking because of vaping, who have quit smoking cigarettes because of vaping.
Right.
And, you know, you talk about.
But I see that's not economic. Well, it is. But that's, I see that more as personal freedoms. And in that area, I think he gets a D+, if that. Because I agree with you. I was disappointed that he went after vapes. I was disappointed he went after bump stocks. I guess I class that as personal freedom rather than economic freedom. I know the two are tied together. You can't really separate them, but.
No, you can't. You know, there, and, you know, the other stuff, you have him talking about wanting to, you do have him sitting there talking about telling, you know, individual businesses what they should do. And I think that, you know, you look at these trial balloons, which have kind of gone up from the Trump administration, whether it's a semi-nationalized 5G system, mm-hmm. You know, whether it's, you know, trying to, you know, raise tariffs, having more of the power to raise tariffs, which they, you know, which the executive has way too much power on tariffs as it is. You know, you look at regulations, and yes, regulations are down from what they were during the Obama administration and from what they were during the George W. Bush administration, but they're still being done. You know, that's the issue you run into when you talk about, you know, Trump wanting to, whether Trump is really a libertarian or not.
Well, I don't think he's a libertarian. I think he's a pragmatist. I mean, honestly, I posted on social media yesterday, and I don't mean this in a sense that, of supporting this idea, but I said what Nancy Pelosi did when she tore up the speech, the SOTU. The Democrats have decided to be antagonistic to probably their best shot of, when they were out of power, getting their agenda done. Because I think President Trump's a pragmatist. When he first came in, before there was any animosity, he was indicative of wanting to do things that they wanted to do on immigration, of wanting to do things that they wanted to do on infrastructure, of wanting to, you know, reform. He wasn't necessarily a free market reformer of healthcare. He wanted to reform healthcare, but he hated Obamacare, but he didn't necessarily want a free market healthcare system. You know, he talked about having, you know, making sure everybody was covered and, you know, that kind of thing. They blew that because I think he's a pragmatist, and now he's just a pissed off pragmatist. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they had an opportunity to advance a lot of the left wing agenda under him as well. And they just they blew that by being antagonistic. I don't see him as even a conservative. Ultimately, he's more conservative than maybe some in the past. But it seems like that's where he's fallen, where he's found his support, as opposed to the rock hard center of his spine. Does that make sense?
To a certain extent, and yet I also sit there and look at Veronique DeRugge, who is a syndicated columnist. She's at George Mason University. If you ever get the chance to talk with her, she has the most amazing French accent. I could listen to her, you know, read from the phone book and I'd just be perfect. She posted this on Reason. It says, a quick overview, this fiscal year, 2020, the federal government will collect $3.6 trillion in tax revenues. But due to its spending addiction, the government will expend $4.6 trillion, which means they're going to have to borrow a trillion this year in order to cover a deficit of 4.6%.
Good Lord.
So, you know, there's a lot of problems.
Right.
Spending is up. And it's not just because Democrats are doing this. Because Republicans are doing this.
Oh, I'd agree. I totally agree. Well, that's why this comes back to kind of full circle our discussion of our politics. I'm not a Republican. I left the Republican Party probably 10 years ago, and I've never been happier. I tend to vote conservative. I tend to most of the time vote for Republicans because it's the least of several bad options. But that brings me to another point I wanted to discuss. And that is this question. Why can't libertarians win big elections?
So a part of it has to do with, define big elections.
Well, it's been a long time since we've had Gary Johnson as governor of New Mexico, and many could consider that to be a fluke. Name another actual libertarian governor. Name another actual libertarian senator besides Rand Paul, but he has to put the label Republican next to his name. Even Ron Paul had to put the label Republican next to his name. Why can't libertarians win? Because in order for them to get a viable presidential candidate, they have to have viable House of Representatives members, and they have to have viable senators, and they have to have viable governors, etc. And I don't even know, personally, I don't even know of any libertarian with an L state legislators. Do you?
I reached out to Jess Mears from the Libertarian Party this morning. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, you know, I know there are libertarians who have been elected. You know, do you have a list? And she was like, hey, there are 177 Libertarian Party members in office, including 56 partisan offices, meaning, you know, you go into the office with a party affiliation on the ballot.
Right.
Now, a lot of it is local government spots. You know,
but I mean, that kind of makes my point, right? In all of this nation, I mean, there's 435 members of Congress. Imagine how many state legislators there are. There's only 56 nationwide that we know of with an L next to it.
So a part of it is ballot access, to be honest. I mean, when people talk about a rigged system, when you hear, you know, I think that was a complaint which Gary Johnson had in 2016, wasn't able to get into the debates. You know, one of the reasons why that is the debate council, you know, the people who helped set up the debates are full of Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
You know, and so they're not going to sit there and say, yeah, let's do a third party.
Their cause when the libertarian presidential candidate is not aware of Aleppo, Syria. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like
that was a trick, you know, something. All right. So that was a trick question. And the person who asked Johnson the question actually later said, I was purposefully doing that because hardly anybody knows Aleppo.
But the point though is that it happened and he didn't handle it well and it became a joke nationwide, and that doesn't help the cause. Gary Johnson knows where Aleppo is. Everybody knows that. He's a smart guy. He's a very smart guy. I like the guy. I'm just pointing out that they keep there's a problem with these traps, and there needs to be that. I mean, you're right. The deck is stacked against them. But at some point, you know, there were the Whigs and the American Party and the Republican Party and the Democrat Party and there were a lot of parties at the beginning of our country. And at some point, the two, Democrat and Republican, became successful. Why can't the Libertarian Party nose its way in?
All right, so it's a nuanced question.
I know.
As I think we've looked at it, it's a nuanced question. And, you know, my counter to the Aleppo, to the Aleppo thing, and again, that was like, what, 5 seconds?
Yeah,
of
totally.
of a 2 minute interaction involving Gary Johnson. Whereas he went, oh yeah, Syria. The answer he gave was a fantastic discussion about why you don't need to be involved in foreign entanglements and why the U.S. getting involved in Syria was a bad idea. The problem is nobody wants to talk about that. They want to focus on the what is Aleppo.
Right.
And that's don't get me wrong. It was a bad look for Johnson.
Right.
It was a horrible look for Johnson. But, you know, it was amplified because of that 5 seconds.
Sure.
You know, and again, it does come down to ballot access, and it does come down to, you know, being able to be on the debate stage. And it also comes down to just historically, as Americans, we are taught you're either a Republican or a Democrat. And
right.
if you're, you know, the thing that we have, I was having a discussion with a family member who, you know, is more conservative than he is leftist, but he's not a fan of Trump. And
right.
he was like, listen, if I have to, I'll vote for Elizabeth Warren if she's the candidate because Trump needs to be out.
Right.
And it's like, no, well, why don't you look at these third parties? And it's like, well, it's just throwing away your vote.
Right.
So that's a part of the issue. And
don't you think though that the biggest part, because this is the thing, and I have a lot of libertarian friends. Again, I lean that way, and I want to see. I would like to see them be a viable party, but whenever I ask this question, why can't they win big elections? The answer is always an excuse. Well, the access, ballot access is stacked against us, or we had trick questions, or whatever this stuff. And I'm like, wait a minute, you're libertarians. You're the anti-victim. You know, I'm like, your entire platform is I am not a victim. Stand on your own 2 feet. Do it the way you back up your own point of view, et cetera. So it's incongruous. There's got to be a way. I guess what I'm getting at is I think the Libertarian Party needs more savvy candidates, understanding the audience, right? Libertarians, I think, have a natural tendency. Don't get me wrong on this, because I think it has to be said. They have a natural tendency to sometimes believe they're smarter than everybody else in the room. That can come across. And it may be true that they're smarter. First of all, I think economically, those of us who have gravitated towards liberty, we are smarter than a lot of people in most of the rooms we're in. But there has to be a way to connect with the average person. The average person doesn't care about the minutiae of why we shouldn't be involved in a trade war with China. All they care about is what is the price of bread and milk and gas, right? And the Libertarian Party, I think, traditionally has had a hard time connecting, hey, these policies right here will make bread and gas and all that stuff cheaper or easier for you to obtain. We need to find candidates that can connect those dots in a way that isn't condescending but is enlightening to people, because it is very nuanced. But we have to take that nuanced topic and enlighten people who are basically studying politics in terms of sound bites. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's something libertarians fail at realizing, including myself. Listen, because everybody wants to boil things down to, you know, 30-second sound bites.
Right.
And sometimes you have arguments which are not 30-second soundbite arguments if you're going to get to that discussion.
Right.
You know, let's look at you had Gary Johnson sit there and say in 2016, you know, there's a lot I agree with Bernie Sanders on.
Mm-hmm.
And then he proceeded to say, but where we disagree is when it comes to the economy, when it comes to, you know, taxation, when it comes to over-intrusive government. What did everybody flock to? Everybody flocked to the, oh, there's a lot I agree with Bernie Sanders
right,
on.
Right.
This was something there was actually a discussion at Hot Air about this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the other thing that people need to realize, there are two other things people need to realize, because we're talking elections right now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, that's what we're talking. We're not getting into policy. We'll get into policy in a minute, because that's a completely different topic. You know, but when you look at electorally, one thing, you know, your friend, and you know him better than I do, but I know him a little bit, Thomas Massie, Congressman mm-hmm. Thomas Massie,
right.
said to the Washington Examiner in 2017 was, you know, the people who were voting for himself and Ron and Rand Paul in the primaries weren't necessarily voting for libertarian ideas. But they were, can I break FCC rules here? Because this is kind of breaking an FCC rule.
As far as I know.
Okay. But they were voting for the craziest son of a bitch in the race.
There's no FCC rules on that in that podcast. Yeah. You're good.
Massie said that. And,
right.
you know, that is, you know, the rise of populism in the United States, which has been going on, you know, really since it really started, I think, in 2005. But, you know, when you had after Hurricane Katrina, when President George W. Bush was like, all right, we're just going to give a bunch of money to New Orleans to help them rebuild. And people were like, excuse me.
Right.
You know, this is horrible, but why is the government doing this? We're like trying to help as much as possible. You know, when you had that to Obama talking about, you know, Obamacare and the Tea Party rallies, and then you had Occupy Wall Street, and then you had, you know, the advent of Trump and the advent of Sanders, you know, you've seen populism really go nationwide.
Right.
And when you have that, you know, when you have the craziest son of a bitch in the race, it doesn't matter if you're sitting there and you're talking about, hey, let's lower taxes. Hey, let's, it doesn't matter if you're talking about things in a very calm manner and being very wonky, people are going to go for the firebrand, which
right.
is why they were attracted to Donald Trump.
Right.
And, you know, the issue that you run into, and honestly, Justin Amash's move to go independent instead of, you know, joining the because in the past, when people go independent, that's just a step for them to join another party.
Right.
Amash is like, I don't like either parties. I'm not going to go with either party. I'm not even going to caucus with any party. You know, that Amash is the true outlier
right.
when it comes to these. He's not a quote unquote independent like Angus King and Bernie Sanders.
So he's a real independent, but the question is, will he be back in Congress, though? The question is,
right.
will he be back in Congress?
Hopefully. Yeah. You know, if he is able to be back in Congress as an independent, that will be the biggest
right.
libertarian victory.
Well, and to your point about policy versus populism, Amash was a conservative hero. There was a picture of him and Massie and I forget who, there was a third one walking down. I think it was him and Massie and Rand walking down
yeah.
the hall of Congress. And everybody loved him. But the moment he didn't like Trump, he suddenly becomes persona non grata. He's the same guy he was. He has the same principles he had. But the cult of personality took over in that moment. And look, I disagree with him on Trump. I happen to support Trump. But I don't necessarily, but if I have a friend who doesn't, I don't throw them out with the bathwater. It's let's have a vigorous conversation. That's fine. So I still respect Justin Amash, same as I did before he did. I might think he was wrong on some things. Doesn't mean I don't respect him. But he was immediately cast out as that sort of Tea Party-ish hero amongst those who've decided that Trump is the future of the Republican Party. So, yeah.
Well,
that's
and a part of it. And a lot of that is, you know, the Trumpetization of the GOP
right.
and the cult of personality and the tribalism, which is going on in Washington.
On both
which
sides.
Is,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to, and I think it's really important to discuss the policy victories libertarians have had, because there's been a lot and people aren't talking about it. But it's been a lot.
Right.
You know, you look at the fact that you have Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete. Yeah, I even have the pronunciation written down and I can't do it. Pete Buttigieg, you know, talking about legalizing all drugs. You know,
right.
he's tied in the Iowa caucus for the Democrats. Libertarians have been arguing this for years.
Right.
In fact, you know, one of the jokes And one of the one of the criticisms, Republicans and Democrats have said about libertarians is, oh, they're just Republicans or they're just Democrats who want to smoke pot.
Right.
You know, I am a small L libertarian, and I've never done a drug classified as illegal by the federal government.
Right. Right. Nor do I want to, even if I want some of them legalized, I don't want to.
And I want them legalized, but do I have a desire? Yeah, not really.
Right.
You look at the fact you have Colorado has legalized pot. California has, a version of legal pot. DC may have a ballot measure on magic mushrooms in November. You know, that's, again, libertarian policy. You look at the death penalty repeals, which are going on across the country in individual states.
Let me interrupt here because we've got a limited amount of time, and I want to get to this because I think you're making an interesting point. All of these policies that you're mentioning are libertarian policies, but when it comes to what people decide to click the vote for, they're not the things. In other words, what I'm saying is, these libertarian policies, I agree with all of them, okay? But ultimately, what people are concerned about when it comes to big elections is, how much is gas? How much is bread? Do I have a job? These are the things, and that's where I think the Republican Party sort of, or the Libertarian Party sort of falls into this trap where they get stuck expounding on those issues, which to the average American don't matter. You know what I'm saying? It's like, how can we connect the policies with, we want to get you back to work. We want to get health insurance to where everybody can afford it. You know what I'm saying? These are the policies that American people are concerned about. And if the Libertarian Party is only talking about legalizing drugs or, where they line up with Bernie or how they don't like Trump or whatever, they're going to completely miss the boat on the policies in terms of being relevant to people's lives. I mean, it's just like if you're going to do a show, if you're going to do a TV show or a movie, it has to be relevant before people are even interested in watching it. And then you can explain all those things, but ultimately we've got to address those key issues, those kitchen table issues, because most people aren't diving into the nuances of politics.
Which is funny because I've had Republicans say that the kitchen table issues don't matter, which I find hilarious.
Right.
Listen, a part of it is candidate. If you put bad candidates out, it's not going to go well. Case in point, with all due respect to Vermin Supreme, he's running as a libertarian.
Right.
Adam Kokesh, who is a libertarian activist, his main thing is his policy is he wants to get rid of the federal government.
Right.
He wants to be elected into office and disband the federal government. And that's not going to work.
Right.
And this is part of the problem, which Libertarian Party, big goals, they want to get rid of the federal government. They want to get rid of, whatever. And the thing you have to sit there and look at, and listen, there are plenty of people who agree with me on this. And Gary Johnson is actually one of the things who said this. You know, he was like, listen, we have to do it incrementally.
Right.
The overarching goal we may want, and I'm talking about libertarians, right?
Right.
An extremely small government. An almost non-existent government, drug legalizations, people able to take their tank to work, people able to go out with their Heckler and Koch, a G36C, fully automatic rifle. You can't just sit there and throw all of it on people.
Right.
You can't throw all of that on people.
Right.
Because they'll sit there and go, what the heck are you talking about? You're crazy.
Exactly.
You can do it incrementally as long as you're able to keep your supporters, together,
right.
Which is why from a policy standpoint, the libertarians are really more successful than people have realized. We haven't even gotten to justice reform.
Right.
You know,
which is sweeping the nation, and both parties are taking credit for it, but it really emanated with libertarian ideals.
Right. And honestly, yeah. You know, Republicans were really the ones who got behind it.
Right.
You know, for all of the problems I might have with Governor Hipster Goodhair, a.k.a. Rick Perry, he got behind justice reform.
Right.
You know, you look at, you know, the stuff in Georgia. You know, you look at, you look at the stuff in Colorado, and the fact that, you know, the death penalty repeal, which may happen, will hopefully happen. One of the main drivers is conservatives concerned about the death penalty.
Yep. Yep.
Which is a conservative group. You look at the stuff FreedomWorks is doing on a justice reform standpoint.
Right.
You know, there are plenty of libertarian-ish groups out there which are driving the policy discussion. And honestly, the policy discussion is what matters more
right.
than winning elections, although elections are very important.
Yeah, and that I think that's a good point, a good place to wrap up too, because what you're talking about is the while the Libertarian Party may not have a lot of L's in Congress or other places, their influence is far and wide, and it's certainly incrementally pushing certain buttons in America, which is valuable. And that continuance of that push, you know, organizations like the Cato Institute and others who I deeply respect, pushing us toward liberty always, even if they never win an election, you know, just pushing us towards, if nothing else, pushing Republicans towards things like that, like criminal justice reform, like embracing, finding novel ways to embrace all different types of people instead of Republicans traditionally saying, you know, we're just going to be the party of rich white people or whatever. They don't traditionally say that, but it's gravitated to that in action. And now we're pushing that back. There's a good pushback against Republicans. Say, look, you got to go and talk to impoverished urban areas. These policies, these economic freedom policies, translate to every single person, regardless of their background and economic status. We want to encourage that and empower that, and that you can see that influence of the Libertarian Party in those things. So, we got to continue this discussion. I think there needs to be more of this, Taylor, and appreciate also the roundup on Hong Kong. I think a lot more people need to pay attention to that. If you care about democracy in the world, I appreciate you taking time to join us. And people can see your stuff on hotair.com. Is there someplace else where they can also find you?
I may end up doing some stuff with Advocates for Self-Government. And you can look me up on Twitter at TaylorMVLR. That's TaylorMVLR. And you can find me on Facebook. Just look up Taylor Millard, M-I-L-L-A-R-D, writer.
Awesome. Fantastic. It's good talking to you. Let's do it again, okay?
Sounds good, Leland. Thanks.
Awesome. Taylor Millard, hotair.com. Terrific guy, terrific writer. Interesting stuff. I think probably the nut of all of that conversation is what we sort of got to there at the end, and that was that perhaps the Libertarian Party's role is never going to be a major political party that elects the majority of Congress, but rather an organization that influences both major parties back to where they should be. And that is, you know, are we supporting individual liberty? And sometimes the Democrats do, and some of their they stumble upon instances where they occasionally are doing something that supports individual liberty. And sometimes Republicans stumble upon things that it supports individual liberty. Maybe behind that is the influence of a broad group of people, a coalition of people who are constantly pushing for more and more freedom. And ultimately, that's probably where you'll find me at the end of the day. I don't belong to any political party. I tend to vote Republican because it tends at the end of the day to be the choice that's best out of whatever two I'm given. But I want to see the influence of more liberty grow in our political system. Ultimately, that's what I want to see happen. So anyway, thanks for listening. It's an interesting conversation. I like those kinds of conversations. You can hear much more of this. I've got a lot more coming. We're going to have a person who's run the Iditarod a couple of times, She is amazing. She's going to be on the Disruption Zone. Lots more to come. I am Leland Conway. You can check us out on thedisruptionzone.com. You can also find me on Twitter. It's at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption. On Instagram, at Great Lelando and at The Disruption Zone. And on Facebook, Leland Conway and The Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening. Thanks again to Dynamics Productions in Lexington, Kentucky, dxaudio.com for all your audio and production needs, for their help with the program. My co-host Cameron Mills wasn't with us today, but he'll be back at some point soon. I am Leland Conway. You're listening to The Disruption Zone.